Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, hardship, family, and our amazing ability as humans to persevere. I had the privilege of interviewing acclaimed poet and author Maya Angelou 3 times over the years. In our last conversation in 2013, she discussed her memoir, Mom and Me and Mom. When Angelou was 3, she was sent to live with her grandmother in Stamps, Arkansas. At 13, Angelou returned to live with her mom in California. In the book, Angelou wrote for the first time about this pivotal era in her life. Her last words to me that day were, "I love you, Diane Rehm, and I look forward to seeing you and talking to you again and again." A year later, she died at the age of 86. This is one of my most treasured interviews, and I'm so happy to share it with you this holiday season. Maya Angelou, good morning to you and welcome.
Good morning to you and welcome.
Oh, Maya, so glad to hear your voice. I hope you are well.
I am well, and I hope the same for you.
You know, I was most interested in your title, Mom and Me and Mom. Tell me what you want to convey.
I wanted to say first there was Mom and what she endured. And then when I joined her, what for a brief second, a brief few years, what I felt. And then again, it was Mom, mm-hmm. and how she grew herself, how she herself in not only endured, but strengthened. So that when I did ask her, when my brother and I asked her, I was 13, my brother 15, and I really disliked the fact that she had abandoned us. And I couldn't get close to her. And my brother asked her, "Why did you leave us so long? Why did you not come and get us?" She said, "Because I wasn't ready." Hmm. I had no capability of being a mother of a small child. She said, at one time, I was 3, and I had asked her for something, and she didn't give it to me, and so I slapped her on the leg. She said, without thinking, she backhanded me off the porch into the dirt. And she said, when she saw me scrambling around in the dirt, knowing that she had knocked me out there, that she said, "I'm not ready. I'm not ready to be a mother." Mm. And she was absolutely right. And Diane, although it was painful, it was angst and storm and just terrible feelings of loneliness and aloneness, I realized she did the best thing for me. Because when I went to my grandmother was a devout Christian, and she spoke quietly. And she was a very tall woman. Even when she died, she was over 6 foot. Very tall woman and very quiet. We couldn't say hot dog, because she said that was a way of cursing. Huh. We couldn't say by the way, because she said Jesus was the way, the truth, and the light. Huh. And so if we said by the way, we were saying by Jesus, and she wouldn't have cursing in her house.
I see.
All of that. But she was also so kind. And although I stayed with her for 10 years, she never once kissed me. But she was so proud of me. She would have visitors over, and she'd tell me to take my shirt off and show my arms. And she'd say, "Now look at these. Look at these. Have you ever seen an arm straighter than this? Straight as a plank and brown as peanut butter."
So clearly she gave you the support, the love. Even though physically she did not show that kind of caring, you knew it was there. The question I have for you, though, is why did you decide to write about your mother now, after all these years?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to write about her about 20 years ago. but the book wasn't ready. And I suppose I wasn't ready. I hadn't learned enough. I didn't know that love was healing. I didn't understand that. And I think I was still wrapped up in the erroneous belief that love had something to do with sentimentality and mush and romance. And after years, I found, oh, I see, that was love. As strange as it may seem, that was love. It was love which allowed her to send her children away, because she wasn't ready for children. There are some people I've found who can be great parents of small children. They put beautiful little bows in their hair and put bow ties on the little boys, and they're amused by the quaint and curious things that they say. And my mother was nothing like that. Nothing. But then there are parents who can take little children, but when the children grow up to 13 or 14, they are no longer amused by them. And they say, shut up, sit down. Don't you have some homework to do? Why don't you go over there and sit down? Okay, you can go out. Yes, please. So, but there were then parents like my mother, who was a fabulous mother of a growing adult.
Huh.
She respected me.
You know, it is interesting to hear you say that there are some young people who are simply not prepared to cope with young children, really young children. And if one could recognize that, as your mother did, it truly is an act of love, rather than, as you interpreted it at the time, an act of rejection. And I'm glad that however many years it took you to reach that point, you did. Tell us about your mother. What was Vivian Baxter's bringing up?
She was amazing. She was the oldest of six children, and her father was a Trinidadian who believed that boys should be, that the violence is a part of their lives, and it's a good part. And so he encouraged them to fight. He said, if you get in jail for thievery or burglary, I'll let you rot. But if you get in jail for fighting, I will sell your mother to go your bail. And so he encouraged her, my mother, since she was the oldest of them, to fight. He encouraged her to teach them how to jump on trains and how to climb trees and how to fight bullies. And she had that always in her. She had an anger that was just under the surface, if there.
So when she and your father met, how did they come together?
Well, they were both beautiful to look at. My father was from Arkansas and had been in World War I. And he was handsome as the devil. And she was very pretty. And I'm sure the lust must have been palpable. They fell for each other. And after a few years, they found they didn't like each other at all.
Huh.
And when they decided to separate, neither of them wanted these toddlers of 3 and 5. So they put us on a train in California and sent us without adult supervision from California to a little village in Arkansas about the size of your studio, and to my grandmother, with just tags on our arms, which said, these children ought to be delivered to Mrs. Annie Henderson in Stamps, Arkansas.
My goodness.
And even now, 80 years later, I still wonder, did we really get that?
Yeah. I mean, you could have gotten off at the wrong stop, or somebody could have taken you off.
Of course. But Pullman car porters and dining car waiters used to children, black children, traveling alone from the North, which had given them their parents' promise, back to the South, which they knew, and they had little promise but very little disappointment. And so dining car waiters and Pullman car porters took us off trains, put us on other trains, and we actually arrived in Stamps, Arkansas.
And your grandmother was waiting for you at the station?
Yes, she was.
How marvelous.
Yes.
And you took a liking to her immediately?
Mm. Yes, I did. I did. I trusted her. And probably because she spoke so quietly and moved so really graciously and gracefully. She wore long dresses. And she used to say, "Sister, you know, Mama don't know what she's going to do, but Mama going to step out on the word. Mama just going to step right out on the word of God." And I could picture this 6-foot-tall woman standing up in the heavens with nothing under her that was visible, just standing and moons around her shoulders and stars around her feet and just stepping out on the... So I wrote her a song. I wrote a song for her, which is sung by, I think, the Mississippi choir, that big 100-voice choir. And it says, "You said to call on your name, and I'm calling. You said to trust in your word, and I'm trusting. To said you lean on your arm, and I'm leaning. I'm stepping out on your word." So that was my...
Oh, how beautiful to hear your voice. Maya, tell us why you stopped talking at age 13.
Mm, yes, actually, I was with Grandmother Henderson in Stamps, Arkansas, from the time I was 3 until I was 7, whereupon my father came down and picked me and my brother up. He came from California to Stamps, got us and took us to St. Louis, where my mother had returned to be with her family. I'm sure he was jealous of this beautiful woman who is now divorced and free to look around. And so he, without telling her we were arriving, he just brought us to her doorstep and rang the doorbell in St. Louis. And there we were, a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old. We stayed with her. She took us in and...
You mean he just deposited you and left?
Yes, ma'am. Without any folderol, without any preparation. So obviously it was an act, an unkind act on his part. It wasn't to give us a better life or a different life. It was to drag her. And so she did take us in, and she was kind and funny. And although they spoke fast and... Neither my brother nor I could really understand those Northerners up in St. Louis. But they did amuse us, and we learned to eat liverwurst and sliced bread and things we'd never even heard of. But then after about 3 months, my mother's boyfriend raped me. And he told me if I told the name of the rapist, he would kill my brother. But my brother was my heart. And so I wouldn't tell anyone. And then my brother said I had to tell him. So I said, "If I tell you, he will kill you." My brother was 9. He said, "I won't let him." So I believed him. I told him. The man was put in jail for 1 day and 1 night and released. And a few days later, the police came to my mother's house and told her in front of me that the man had been found dead. And it seemed he'd been kicked to death. I thought my voice had killed him. So I stopped speaking. For 6 years to everyone but my brother. Somehow I knew that my love for him and his for me were too strong. Our loves were too strong to allow any curse to get between us and hurt him. So my mother's people did their best. I give them. They did their best to woo me away from my mutism. But they didn't know what I knew about the power of my voice. So after a few more months, they wearied of the presence of this sullen, silent child. So they sent us back to Mama in Stamps, Arkansas.
To your grandmother.
To my grandmother, who I adored. And Mama would say, she'd braid my hair. the way old black ladies still braid girls' hair. The girl sits on the floor on a pillow, and the mama sits in a chair, and she just takes a brush and brushes this mass of curls. So my hair was very thick and very curly. So mama would braid my hair, and she'd bend her hand, the left hand, around and put it behind my neck so she wouldn't break my neck by accident. And she'd say, now, sister, mama don't care what these people say about you. You must be a moron or you must be an idiot because you can't talk. Sister, mama don't care. Mama know when you and the good Lord get ready, sister, you're going to become a teacher. You're going to teach all over this world. And Diane Rehm, I used to sit there and think, this poor ignorant woman, doesn't she know I will never speak? And now I have taught at the Habima Theater in Israel and in Tel Aviv and a journalist in Egypt and translator in Serbo-Croat and Yugoslavia. I teach in Spanish and French.
Your grandmother, was so right.
So wise. She was the daughter of a former slave. How did this woman know so much? She was just wise. She was wisdom itself.
And Maya, what was it that finally broke your silence?
Well, it was poetry, really. There was a woman in our town, a black lady, who took me to the black school. She knew I wasn't going to talk, but she said, I want you to read every book in this library. So I read every book. I didn't know what I was reading most of the time, but I read. And I found I loved poetry. I could almost hear it. And I would write it down. And finally, one day, I was about 12, and she invited me to her house, and she used to read to me. And she said, you know something, Maya, you don't love poetry. So I had a little tablet my grandmother had given me. I wrote, yes, ma'am, and tried to give her the tablet. She said, no, you don't love poetry. You will never love it until you speak it. Feel it come across your tongue, over your lips. You'll never love poetry. I ran from her. I ran out of her house. She followed me. She harassed me for months. And finally, I went under the house, under my grandmother's store, which was built on stilts. And the dirt under the store was soft like powder because of chickens. And I went under the house with Bailey, and I realized I had left my voice. My voice had not left me. And I started speaking. I admit, slowly at first. I didn't trust it at first. At 13, we were sent back to, my grandmother took us back to California, because Bailey was by that time 15, and my grandmother was afraid that a 15-year-old, a teenage boy, growing up in the South, if he looked at a white girl and whistled, he could be lynched.
Indeed.
So she took us back. And slowly, I learned to talk again. And I learned to trust my mother. At first, I couldn't stand her. She laughed all the time. She wore lipstick, real red lipstick, and high-heeled shoes. And she did the time step and danced in the kitchen and danced in the living room and had records players all the time.
But, you know, there was one really significant moment when your mother saw you. She said, Maya, Marguerite, my baby,
yes.
And she kissed you.
Yes. I had never been called anybody's baby. I had never been called anybody's daughter. And she told me, she said, I want you to smile. Smile for me. And I couldn't. And she made faces. She put her fingers in her mouth and pulled her lips across and crossed her eyes. And finally, I did laugh. I laughed at her, and she started to cry.
Oh.
She said, you have a beautiful smile.
Oh.
Mother's baby has a beautiful smile. And she went around the house telling people, you should see my baby's smile.
Now, Vivian Baxter ran a gambling business at a rooming house with her husband, Daddy Caudill. Yes. And she was also a registered nurse. She became the first black woman officer in the Merchant Marines.
That's true.
So you had to have understood her power.
Yes.
You chose to address your mother as lady and not mom. How come?
Well, she didn't seem like a mother to me. Mother was my grandmother. And mothers spoke softly, and mothers were gentle, I thought. And Vivian Baxter was so pretty and so quick, and she sang rough songs, blues, you know, with some lyrics that even made me blush at 13 and 14. But she would sing these songs and dance, and Bailey would laugh, but I didn't think it was funny. I didn't think her mother should do that. So she said to me after, I wouldn't call her mother, she said, you're going to have to address me as something. What would you like to call me? And I said, lady. And lady, she asked why. I said, because you're very pretty. You don't look like a mother.
Huh.
And she said, all right.
Eventually, you did begin calling her mom.
That's true.
That must have meant that she had somehow won me over.
She won me over. Diane, she was kind. She was kind to everybody. The poorer the person, the kinder she was. And she never laughed at people, at their infirmities. She, when the person was in her presence, she was kind. When the person left, she didn't then make her face into a kind of scowl and laugh. She really felt sympathy and empathy for people.
How about your brother, Bailey? How did he see your mother? How did he experience being back at home with her?
Not positively. He loved her so. I think he was in love with her, and he just couldn't stand that she was loved by my stepfather. And also he was jealous and thought that other men wanted her. They may have, but he was jealous. And before my brother we stayed in Arkansas, my brother would have probably gone to Howard University or Fisk and become a lawyer. We went to California, and by the time he was 19, he was in drugs.
Oh, and no one could do anything about it?
No.
Oh, Maya. How long did that go on?
Well, almost all his life, he fought drugs, and I fought drugs with him. I used to go to houses where they sold drugs and shoot up houses. And I would just go in and say, I'm here for my brother. I'm here to get my brother. And all the druggers understood. And I would get Bailey and take him outside. And sometimes we'd sit. Ah.
Why do you think you were not tempted?
Honestly, Diane Rehm, I never know. I can just say it was the prayers of my grandmother. And I have no idea. I just know every day when I awaken, I thank God for it. I am just so blessed beyond the talking of it. I just saw in today's news that there are five celebrities from around the United States were listed, and five of them, the top was Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock, Denzel Washington, and the fourth person I don't remember, but the fifth person is Maya Angelou. It's amazing. And I have 4 million people on the Facebook list. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
I'm just blessed beyond the telling
indeed,
of it.
Indeed.
And I'm grateful.
And tell us what happened to your brother.
Well, finally, I moved to North Carolina, and I was able to bring him here. And he died here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
How old was he?
About 75.
And by then, had he finally rid himself of the drug habit?
The drug habit pursued him.
Ah.
Even here, where I live here and I'm known here, and my church is here and my school is here, even here, people could still get to him. And his daughter lives here. And somehow they were able to elude both of us and get to him.
Oh, Maya, I want to ask you about why you almost left your mother's home at age 15.
Well, at 15, I was just coming around to liking her and accepting her. And I went out one night with some kids, and we went way across town. And I wasn't supposed to go anywhere without Bailey, but I'd gotten caught up in the group, and we found ourselves way across town without car fare. And so a group of us walked home from the Spanish-speaking area, to the Fillmore. And when I walked in, it was after 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oof.
I put my key in the door, and my mother, and the door pushed back the other way to me, and my mother stepped out on the platform, the first step of the, and she hit me. She had a bunch of keys in her hand, and she hit me in the face with her fist, and I screamed, and she pulled me inside and said, "The whores are in bed." And my 15-year-old daughter is walking the street, and she was screaming at the top of her voice. And my stepfather and other people came out, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And my brother came downstairs, and he said, "Let's go." He heard all that, and he saw me crying. And he said, "Let's go. Let's go upstairs." And he took me by the hand and took me to my room and said, "Now wash your face, and here's this, and here's it." He said, "I'll figure out what we're going to do." So about 3 hours later, I'd stopped crying, and I looked in the mirror, and my face had swollen, and my teeth. It was just terrible. And my brother brought a bag in, and said, "Put 2 skirts and 2 underslips and 2 this in there, and let's go." And I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "I don't know, but we're leaving this house." We walked down the steps, and my mother saw us. And she said, "Where the hell do you think you're going?" And Bailey said, "Anywhere but here." And she looked up and saw me, and saw my face swollen, my eyes blue and black. And she said, "Oh, please, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." And Bailey said, "Nobody beats up my baby sister." Now, you have to picture this, too. Bailey, I was at 15, I was 6 foot. At 17, he was 5'4.5". And so my mother said, "Please come into the kitchen. Please, please, please. Let me explain something." So we did. We followed her to the kitchen, and she took a tea towel off the rack and put it on the floor. She asked us to sit on the chairs. And she knelt down on the floor and prayed to God for forgiveness.
Oh.
Then she prayed to me. And she said, everybody had gone to bed. And she was locking up the house, and had about 20 keys on this ring. And she passed my door, and the door was open. And I wasn't in there. And she began to wonder what on earth, and had somebody taken advantage of me. And as she walked down the steps, I put the key in the door, and I was smiling. And she exploded. She said, "Please, I beg you, I beg you." And I thought about leaving her. And I thought, she loves me. And it's not that she hit me because she loved me. She loved me, and she's sorry that she hit me. And I understood that then. 2 years later, when I had a baby and I told her I was leaving, my baby was 2 months old, I said, "I'm leaving your house." And she had live-in help and all of that. She said, really? I said, yes, I found a room and with cooking privilege down the hall. The landlady will be the babysitter, and I found a job. She said, all right, remember this. You already have been raised. You know the difference between right and wrong. Do right. That's all. And there is this thing to never forget. You can always come home.
Oh.
And at that moment, I was flushed with love for her, and it has never decreased from that moment on.
So that was truly a turning point in your relationship.
Yes, absolutely.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my 2013 conversation with Maya Angelou.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my 2013 conversation with acclaimed poet and writer Maya Angelou about her memoir, Mom and Me and Mom. We have many, many callers. I want to open the phones now. Let's go first to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Lauren. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Maya Angelou, I cannot believe I'm talking to you. I've loved you since I was a 10-year-old little girl in St. Louis, and you are what made me love poetry.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My question is just about your advice for forgiveness. You describe these terribly hard things from your childhood, but you're able to forgive in such a beautiful, poetic way, really. What would you advise for other people?
Well, one of the things I've done, Miss Laura, is I've changed that word to make it two words and turn it around, to give for. So if I have someone who has embarrassed me or broken a promise to me or betrayed me or in any way hurt my feelings, I will find something, a bag of potatoes, a bag of onions, and a roast, and give it to a needy family. And I say, I'm giving this for Joe, who hurt my feelings. And somehow I'm free. I'm not carrying Joe around on my back. I'm not tugging him along everywhere I go. He's not making me look old and tired and weird. I'm free of him. I have given for him. I don't know where I got that, but that's what I do.
Great advice. Here is a message posted on Facebook from RC. It says, one of my favorite quotes from Maya Angelou is, there is a very fine line between loving life and being greedy for it.
That's right.
In today's fast-paced world, many of us have become human doings instead of human beings. So many Americans are consumed with consumption. Many are adrenaline junkies, many hyper-focused on achievement and approval. Yet many of us miss the simple yet profound experience of just being lovingly present with our fellow human beings on this great earth.
What a statement. What a one. Thank you so much for saying that.
Isn't that
I believe
beautiful?
In everything you've said.
Absolutely. Maya, talk about Mark, who he was, and how your mother saved you from him.
Well, he was a wonderful-looking man. Wishes for horses. Yes, he was incredible looking, and he was very kind at first, very generous. And then one night, I left a movie house, and he picked me up, and drove me out to an area outside of San Francisco called Half Moon Bay. He said to get out of the car. It was very romantic. It was over a cliff looking right out at the bay. It was beautiful. So I got out of the car, and he came around and hit me.
Oh.
And really beat me. And sometimes I'd be unconscious, and I'd wake up, and he'd have me standing against a wall of the cliff.
Oh.
And hit. He finally put me in the back of his car and drove to Betty Lou's Chicken Shack, which was a restaurant in downtown San Francisco in the black area. And he called some men over and said, "This is what you do to a he used the word bitch, who has been unfaithful."
Oh.
And the men went back into the chicken shack, into the restaurant, and told Miss Betty Lou, who was a friend of my mother, that this man, Mark, had me. And they thought I was dead in the back of his car. So Miss Betty Lou called my mother, and my mother called Boyd Puccinelli, who was a bail bondman. He said he didn't have this man. He didn't have any name for him, but he'd find him. So my mother called the police and all that, and the man took me to his room in a rooming house. And I remember once awaking, and he had a razor blade, a single-edge razor blade. He put it to his throat. He said, "I should kill myself. I've treated you so badly." And then he said, "No, I'll kill you." And he put the razor to my throat, and he said, "Because I can't leave you here for somebody else to have." He was mad, of course. I went to sleep. I couldn't sit up. I only found later that my ribs had been broken. He said, "I'm going to get you some pineapple juice. You like juice?" He said, "I'm going to the store. I'm going to get it, and then I'm going to nurse you back to health. Don't worry." He left the room, and I couldn't even get up off the pillow.
Oh.
And I prayed, "Please let something happen, or take my life. Don't let him take it." A little while, I don't know how much later, I heard a llama, llama, llama down the hall, screaming and people kicking doors, and my mother's voice saying, "Break it down, break the SOB down." And two huge men that she'd gotten from her pool hall broke down the door of this man's room, of Mark's room. And my mother stepped in, and she fainted when she saw me. She said it was the only time in her life she'd ever fainted. But I was just really, really beaten up.
How long did it take you to heal?
I guess about 3 or 4 months.
Oh, my.
It was terrible.
You know, when I hear you talk about all these experiences in your life, the rape as a young girl, the loss of your mother, the regaining of her, the kind of treatment you've had at the hands of some people, one has to wonder whether the blessings of your grandmother were so deep inside you that you simply knew you would survive.
Yes. I wanted to say something away from my own situation in this book. I like you so much, Diane Rehm, and so does your audience. And I have a feeling all the time that you and I are best friends. And I know that if we lived near each other, at least we'd see each other once a month, have a cup of coffee, a glass of wine, or something together. I think that you are the kind of best friend everybody would like to have. You're honest, you're direct, and you're not brutal. Some people think they say, "I'm brutally frank." That's stupid. You don't have to be brutal about anything. And that's what you're frank, you're direct, and you're also kind. And I like you very much.
Maya, such lovely words coming from you. I shall treasure them forever.
Thank you.
Let's go to Englewood, Florida. Fidelio, you're on the air.
Good morning, almost afternoon.
Good morning.
My question, I would really love to get your opinion on this. I feel truly betrayed in a true loving relationship of, you know, many years, 20 years. And when you forgive someone, okay, I've moved on. It's been, you know, it's been over 5 years. The hurt, you know, occasionally comes and haunts you. The specter is there. But my thing is, when I do understand letting go, and I have moved on, there are still people who say, well, what, you know, you should be able to see this person in public. And my question is, if someone has really betrayed you, hurt you, whatever, they're very severe, and you have moved on, and you have realized, well, that was that, and this is now.
All right.
Are you wrong not to say, but I just don't need to be a part of that person or their situation?
Thank you for the question. It's one that it troubles me sometimes. But I also know that just as I have asked God to forgive me, I do forgive people. At the same time, God has given me intelligence. I know now that fire burns. Okie dokie. I have learned that. I don't have to put my hand in fire anymore. I don't have to explain myself to the brute why I don't want to be in his or her company. People tell you who they are. Once they tell you, believe them. They know themselves better than you do. So, okay, you're this kind of person. You're a betrayer. All right, I see that. I forgive you for the action you did to me because I've given for you. I'm finished with that. But I'm not going to put myself in the arena again. No, I won't do that. I've got good sense.
Maya Angelou, Reynolds Professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University, her new memoir, Mom and Me and Mom. I love you, Maya.
I love you, Diane Reen.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you and talking to you again and again.
That was my 2013 interview with Maya Angelou about her memoir, Mom and Me and Mom. And that's all for today. I wanted to let you know we're taking a break for the holidays. We'll be back with a new podcast on January 5th. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Ben Privett. Thanks for listening, all. I wish you and your loved ones a happy and healthy holiday. I'm Diane Reen.